The headlines: NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg says the alliance is looking to reset eastern defenses amid the conflict in Ukraine. Moscow is about to expel several American diplomats in retaliation for Washington's expulsion of a dozen Russian representatives to the UN. And Iran renews its call for an end to the Saudi-led aggression on Yemen as the war is nearing its seventh anniversary. Hello and welcome, everybody. It's 2:30 p.m. here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. You're watching Press TV's World News. Our top story for this half-hour: NATO leaders are gathering today in Brussels for an extraordinary summit. Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg says the alliance is looking to reset its eastern defenses over Russia's offensive in Ukraine.
We have increased our military presence in the eastern part of the alliance. The NATO leaders will today address the need for a reset of our deterrence and defense in the longer term. Putin has made a big mistake, and that is to launch a war, to wage war against an independent sovereign nation. He has underestimated the strength of the Ukrainian people, the bravery of the Ukrainian people and the armed forces.
NATO leaders are expected to address different aspects of the conflict. Among the main topics are strengthening battle groups in several member states, increasing support for countries under pressure because of the Ukrainian crisis, as well as China's role in the ongoing developments. U.S. President Joe Biden is in the Belgian capital as well. He's going to address G7 leaders and meet with EU officials. Meantime, the U.S. is set to introduce a new package of sanctions on Russian political figures and oligarchs today. Western governments are flooding Ukraine with more military and other types of support amid Russia's military operation. Britain says it will provide an additional 6,000 missiles. According to the Office of Prime Minister Boris Johnson, London will also provide around $33 million in funding to the Ukrainian military. That's besides over $5 million to support the BBC's coverage in the region. Johnson will announce the measures at the summit of the NATO and Group 7. On Thursday, the Prime Minister has already pledged to step up military and economic support for Ukraine. Germany is also sending 2,000 additional anti-tank weapons. It has already supplied 2,000 missiles and missile launchers. Look at some of the top stories of the day on this edition of the program. Tensions ratcheting up between the United States and Russia over Ukraine. Washington says Moscow is expelling several American diplomats from the U.S. Embassy, declaring them persona non grata. The State Department made the announcement, calling it another unproductive and unhelpful step in bilateral relations. Russian media, however, say the expulsions are in response to Washington expelling a dozen members of Russia's UN mission in New York last month. Simultaneously, President Vladimir Putin has announced that Russia's gas sales to what he called unfriendly countries would from now on be conducted in its local currency, the ruble. The list includes the U.S., the U.K., EU nations alongside Japan and Canada. These are the countries that have sanctioned Russia over its operation in Ukraine. Well, joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have writer and political analyst Fred Weir joining us from Moscow. And also we have author and commentator John Stepling, who's joining us from Indre, Norway. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Weir in Moscow. Talk to us about the expulsion of diplomats from both countries coming from Moscow and Washington. It looks like bilateral relations between Russia and the United States is in free fall right now.
Well, it's basically been in free fall since 2014. I've lost count of the numbers of tit-for-tat diplomatic expulsions. This, of course, every time we say it just can't get worse. And it does, and now it's just catastrophically terrible. I don't think that there's anything productive in these expulsions. I mean, I agree with the U.S. State Department on that point, except that they're doing it. They're finding new ways to hit at Russia. And this is in every way a war, except that there isn't direct contact between NATO and Russian forces, and let's hope it stays that way. But in every other way, they're at war, and this expulsion of diplomats from the UN, it's absolutely unprecedented thing. It's supposed to be illegal, but they did it. So how are the Russians to respond? I guess they respond by expelling an equal number of diplomats from the already skeleton crew at the U.S. Embassy here in Moscow. So will that help anybody? Will that improve the chances for dialogue, especially if it becomes urgently needed? Of course not.
John Stepling, I'd like to get your thoughts on the same issue. Right now, if I'm correct, on March 21st, the Russian Foreign Ministry said the relations between Moscow and Washington were on the brink of collapse. What's next? Are you seeing a downgrading or severing of ties altogether between these two?
I think it's close to completely severed as it is. They aren't really speaking. You know, you have to remember that media in general, global media, is a Western hegemon. I mean, it's all platformed in Western countries, primarily the United States. So the U.S. is going to win the propaganda war, and that's what they're doing. I mean, we're seeing things such as a Swedish yogurt company removing a yogurt from their shelves that was called Russian yogurt with a picture of St. Basil's Cathedral. It was made in Sweden entirely. It was just but it was taken off the shelves. A Russian chess grandmaster has been banned for 6 months because he said something positive about Putin. You know, it's like freedom fries all over again. It's reached levels of absolute insanity and irrationality now. But it's something that the U.S. has a huge advantage with. But, you know, your other guest mentioned 2014. That's the crucial point here, is that the U.S. orchestrated this coup in 2014 that drove out a Russian-friendly somewhat government, the Fatherland Party, replaced it with the regime that's in power now, infested with fascists and hyper-nationalists, Nazis, and has carefully picked who was going to end up as President. Zelensky, Victoria Nuland, thought he played well to the West and that people like Klitschko were too Slavic. I mean, she said things like this. There were phone records of her discussion. So the 2014 looms as a crucial date here, because in one sense the government in Kiev is illegitimate. It's a Western proxy, and it has allowed for, you know, a further expansion of NATO closer to Russian borders. And meanwhile, the Azov Battalion and Right Sector and so forth have taken to shelling Donbass for the last 7 years. Donbass is a very poor mining region in eastern Ukraine. 14,000 civilians have died, reportedly. Russia went to the UN about that. Putin gave a speech in 2015 about this. They were ignored. Because these big global institutions, again, fall under the umbrella of Western hegemony. So this is you know, a topic that is virtually invisible in Western media. The shelling, the fact that the U.S. orchestrated the coup that put this party in power, and nobody asked, well, Russia tried diplomatic solutions and they were rejected. What were they supposed to do? You are then, if you ask that question, you were accused of defending this invasion. And yet, nobody has given me an answer to that. It's a you know, the ultimate responsibility for this crisis, it seems to me, falls at the feet of the United States and NATO.
Mr. Weir, let's focus on one of these reactions, fighting fire with fire. In addition to the United States, it seems that other countries such as Poland and Estonia, they're also starting to expel Russian diplomats. Has a precedent been set now to act in this manner? And how do you think Russia will be responding to all this?
Precedent is a very old one. It's just running wildly out of control right now. And Russia will respond in the traditional way, tit for tat. So if it was 40 Russian diplomats from Poland, if there are 40 Polish diplomats in Moscow, they're all gone. That's as predictable as a thing can be. Otherwise, as I said earlier, it's just cutting off all possible means of communication that is only done in wartime. I've never seen anything quite like this. These are meant to be demonstrative actions, you know, to punish. But what they're doing is hacking into the last remaining circuitry of international dialogue. It just is so depressing to see it, because it's pointless. In the past, often countries have been able to keep channels open, even in the worst circumstances. I mean, let's just pause and remember, without wanting to get into historical examples, but the Cuban Missile Crisis was solved peacefully because Khrushchev and Kennedy and their people talked directly every day. They enhanced dialogue in the midst of that crisis, and that's what eventually ended it safely for all of us. I was a young man at the time, a boy, but I'm grateful to them for that. I don't know what's going to happen now, but I'm really scared.
John Stepling, one of the issues in the NATO Leaders Summit is to try and pressure China not to side with Russia. How can the West go about pressuring China? Is it sanctions? Is it warnings? Because economic sanctions on China, that's a whole different ballgame.
Well, I don't think they can pressure China particularly. It's, you know, in 2019, this is relevant, is, let me digress a second. In 2019, the Rand Corporation issued a paper that was very influential in the corridors of power in the U.S., and it was called A Plan to Overextend and Unbalance Russia. And part of that was to provoke a Russian response in Ukraine through, you know, creating a government in Ukraine that was hostile to Russia. Russia would react, and then the U.S. and the West would be able to implement massive sanctions against Russia. This has all taken place. This is exactly what's happening. I'm not sure, however, short term, this will hurt Russia to some degree. It will probably help the U.S. to some degree. Long term, I think most certainly it's going to cripple the United States economically, who is already crippled. And I want to mention, your other guest brought up the Cuban Missile Crisis. I was about to do the same thing. I was a young boy then, too. And I remember it, and it is a perfect example. It's a perfect parallel example that the Soviet Union brought missiles 60 miles from the shores of Florida, and the U.S. reacted, you know, immediately and intensely objected to it. But somehow bringing missiles, you know, 60 or 160 kilometers from the Russian border in Ukraine is deemed as perfectly reasonable, and that Russia has no right to complain about that and has no right to take any sort of action to stop this eastward expansion of NATO. NATO is a U.S. proxy. No matter what anybody cares to think about it, it is essentially run by and controlled by the United States. So I'm scared, too. It's a terrifying prospect. And I don't think I scare easily, or I am prone to hyperbole, but it's a terrifying prospect, because I think, especially in the United States, we have people in power who are really out of touch with reality.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. Writer and political analyst Fred Weir joining us from Moscow. Author and commentator John Stepling joining us from Inderøy, Norway. And with that, it brings us to an end here on this edition of the News Review. Welcome back. Iran renews its call for an end to the Saudi-led aggression on Yemen ahead of the 7th anniversary of an offensive that it's describing as a destructive war and a cruel blockade. According to the foreign ministry, Tehran backs any fair and practical initiative to end the blockade, establish truce, and launch talks to resolve the crisis. In its statement, the ministry noted that any talks should be led by Yemenis and away from foreign interference, it also slammed the blockade on food, fuel, and other basic supplies into Yemen. It said the crisis is lingering due to Western arms supply, as well as support for the aggressors at the UN Security Council. Since March 2015, the war has killed hundreds of thousands of Yemenis, either directly or indirectly. The UN says the war and blockade have pushed Yemen into the worst humanitarian crisis of the century. Well, South Korea says its northern neighbor has fired an unknown projectile, which could be an intercontinental ballistic missile. Japan has also confirmed the launch. The purported ballistic missile has been fired toward the sea off North Korea's east coast. Seoul and Washington have been warning that North Korea could resume test firing its largest intercontinental ballistic missiles at any moment. Less than 2 weeks ago, Pyongyang launched another suspected ballistic missile that reportedly failed right after launch. Officials in North Korea say the latest spate of missile tests is in response to the provocations and destabilizing moves by the U.S. and its regional allies on the Korean Peninsula. Our correspondent in Seoul, Jennifer Chang, has more to tell us about North Korea's latest launch. Let's take a listen.
Well, North Korea typically does not comment on its tests until the day after the test, and it described its recent tests as launches of a spy satellite system to watch South Korea and U.S. military drills and military movements, because the U.S. and South Korea hold regular drills to practice invading North Korea. And furthermore, the South has just elected a new president who says he's justified in launching a preemptive military attack on North Korea in the event that he thinks that an invasion by North Korea of the South is imminent. So this means that the North has to do something to defend itself. Now, the U.S. claims that this is not a spy satellite that they are launching repeatedly, that this is a series of tests to perfect a new ICBM, the Hwasong-17, which is a huge ICBM armed with multiple nuclear warheads that can strike any U.S. city. This is their first ICBM test in more than 4 years. And this test was clearly a big success. It flew further and it flew higher than the previous Hwasong-15 test in 2017. This reached an altitude of 6,000 kilometers and it flew 1,100 kilometers, landing in Japan's exclusive economic zone. The U.S. is worried because this latest test was such a big success.
That's a wrap for now.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com. rib.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the televised speech delivered on March 1st, 2022, by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of Mab'ath. Well, today life in the Western civilization is based on greed and avarice. Today, the basis of all Western values is money. Science is at the service of killing people. Science and technology are at the service of killing people. Sometimes, one uses money to produce such and such a vaccine and medicine to save a number of people. And sometimes, one uses it to build weapons of mass destruction and chemical and atomic weapons, which kill a hundredfold amount of people. This has already happened, and it continues to happen in the world. I can equally mention the plunder of weak countries, extreme moral decadence and chaos, homosexuality, and the like, that one is ashamed even mentioning them. Today, a strange sexual chaos exists in the world. These are things that existed in those days and in the present time. However, in those days, such things were limited in scope, but today they are very large in scope and are done in a systematic way. For many of these forms of corruption and vices, fake rationalizations have been fabricated.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
They have fabricated an intellectual basis and source of support for it, and they present it to humanity. So, this modern ignorance is there in the world today. Therefore, if someone refers to today's Western civilization as modern ignorance, as some people have already done, they are right, because it is the same ignorance, but it is showing itself in a modern and modernized way. So what should we do? We should review the lessons of Ba'tha. We should treat today's ignorance in the same way the Holy Prophet ﷺ treated those days' ignorance. This is our responsibility. We should primarily strengthen faith, an important duty for us and for all those who love humanity throughout the world is to strengthen religious faith and to develop pious and resistant groups all over the globe. People who are religiously motivated, who have faith, who are resistant and who work hard. These groups should be expanded.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
With the conflict between Russia and Ukraine ongoing for over 3 weeks, Turkey is playing a significant role to de-escalate the tensions. The country is hosting high-level discussions between the two sides aimed at reaching a ceasefire, expressing readiness to host talks between the presidents of Ukraine and Russia. In the meantime, reports suggest that the United States has informally suggested that Turkey send its Russian-made S-400 missile defense systems to Ukraine to help Kiev with its fight against Russian forces. The report suggests that American officials have floated the idea with their Turkish counterparts, but no formal request was made. The idea was also mentioned during Deputy State Secretary Wendy Sherman's visit to Turkey earlier this month. That seems too convenient for the U.S. and its Western allies that have been asking Turkey to abandon its Russian-made air defenses and instead use American-made Patriot counterparts.
Yes, it's exactly the same system that they complained about earlier, but the political geometry has changed a little bit, so the United States is trying to turn things around to try and bring Turkey closer and to separate it a little more from Russia and to overcome the debacle for the U.S. that the Turkey's purchase of these missiles created earlier.
Observers say Turkey will almost certainly reject the proposal, but the fact that it's even being offered reveals the West's opportunistic policies. Turkey signed a multi-billion dollar agreement to acquire several batteries of Russia's S-400 missile defense system in 2017. The West wasn't pleased with the deal, arguing that installing such systems in a NATO country would potentially compromise the security of the military alliance, as well as pose a risk to the newly developed F-35 fighter jets. The first batch of the Russian-made system was delivered to Turkey in 2019, enraging the West. Former U.S. President Donald Trump imposed sanctions on Turkey over the incident and cut Ankara, a financial and manufacturing partner, from the F-35 program. Turkey has demanded repayment of some $1.4 billion it put into the program, but so far hasn't received anything back. Turkey stresses that it opted for the Russian system as the Western-made counterparts were not offered to it at agreeable terms. The U.S. suggestion that Ankara, send its S-400 missile defense system to Ukraine to shoot down Russian fighter jets, apart from the technical hurdles of delivering and installing them, would potentially risk a Russian blowback. Washington has certainly predicted that any deterioration of ties between Ankara and Moscow could harm Turkey's position as a neutral broker and derail the ceasefire talks. That raises some serious questions about the U.S. stated willingness to end the conflict in Ukraine as soon as possible.
The spokesman for Yemen's armed forces, Brigadier General Yahya Sari'a, says Sana'a has staged a fresh retaliatory operation against the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia in a bid to break the all-out blockade Riyadh has imposed on its southern neighbor. Yahya Sari'a noted that targets in Saudi Arabia's port city of Jeddah, as well as Jizan, have been struck in the third phase of special operations. Earlier, Sari announced the second phase, saying Yemeni forces had conducted major operations, which he described as special in nature, and that the mission had been carried out successfully. He pointed out the large-scale operation has been staged with a batch of ballistic missiles and drones. According to the spokesman, Phase 2 involved projectiles flying across the border, targeting a number of vital and sensitive sites in the regions of Abha, Khamis Umshayat, Jizan, and Samata, as well as southern Tehran, with facilities belonging to Saudi oil giant Aramco among the sites targeted. Saudi state media acknowledged a barrage of drone and missile attacks. Despite the kingdom claiming to have intercepted the projectiles, it later reported that drones had hit a petroleum distribution terminal, a natural gas plant, and an oil refinery that led to a temporary reduction in the refinery's production levels. On March 11, Sari announced the first phase of this operation, which also included the bombing of a number of vital and sensitive Saudi facilities affiliated with Aramco in Riyadh, among other areas. He has stressed that the operations come within the framework of Yemen's legitimate right to respond to what he labeled as an unjust siege. According to UN experts, the Saudi-led blockade on Yemen is having a catastrophic effect on millions of people.
The Yemenis have suffered a lot because they cannot import even food or medicine. And the past 70 years have been hell to the Yemenis. And it is now seven painful years for them, and the world is just watching.
Sari'a has pledged that the Yemeni armed forces will carry out more military operations in the not-so-distant future to break the siege, warning Riyadh the upcoming retaliatory attacks will include sensitive targets that are beyond the imagination of the Saudis. The Saudi war on Yemen is on the brink of its seventh anniversary. On March 26, 2015, Riyadh and a number of its regional allies, backed by the United States, declared war on Yemen. Riyadh said the offensive would take a couple of weeks to achieve its goals, one of which was to restore the former government in Sana'a, whose term had expired but was loyal to the Saudis. However, 7 years later, analysts say the kingdom and its allies, including Washington, have underestimated the determination and the steadfastness of the Yemeni forces and nation to seek sovereignty from Saudi rule. In normal warfare, Saudi Arabia would have the upper hand in this war. Riyadh enjoys unwavering support from the West, in particular the United States. Washington has provided logistical and intelligence backing to the Saudi Air Force, while the UK has trained Saudi pilots. But the real support has come in the form of arms sales. America and its Western allies have sold the Saudis advanced weapons to the tune of hundreds of billions of dollars, making a massive profit. Despite warnings by rights groups of Western complicity in war crimes amid an indiscriminate Saudi bombardment campaign that has killed women and children, Western weapons continue to flow into the kingdom. Despite all this support, the question is, after 7 years, why can't Saudi Arabia win its war on Yemen?
They do not have legitimate goals by waging the war. Number two, their people, their soldiers have become demoralized because of their inability to score victories over the Yemenis. And thirdly, the Yemenis are known historically for their power.
Under a tight blockade, Yemeni forces have manufactured their own indigenous ballistic missiles and drones. Despite their relatively low costs in comparison with Saudi weapons, they have proven very effective. Yemeni officials say they have no choice but to expand retaliatory operations against targets deep inside Saudi Arabia, with the goal of forcing Riyadh to end its blockade and to end its air raids.
Syrian President Bashar al-Assad has visited the United Arab Emirates in his first such visit to an Arab state since the beginning of foreign-backed violence in Syria in 2011. Meeting with Assad on Friday, Abu Dhabi Crown Prince Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan stressed that Syria is a fundamental pillar of Arab security. The Emirati official added that his country is keen to strengthen cooperation with Syria, describing the two nations as brotherly peoples. Assad, for his part, urged that in order to protect the regional countries must continue with adherence to their principles, the sovereignty of their countries, and the interests of their peoples. Assad's visit to the UAE took place only months after the Emirates' foreign minister, Abdullah bin Zayed Al Nahyan, traveled to the Syrian capital, Damascus. It also came amid the widely reported prospect of Damascus' return to the Arab League regional bloc.
So they are, along with the Saudi Arabia, they are rethinking their alliances with the United States, especially, and putting all of their eggs in the United States basket. They are thinking of, let's say, diversifying their alliances along other lines and looking towards China and Russia and other nations.
The recent thaw in relations comes despite the fact that almost all of the region's Arab states turned their backs on Syria in 2014 when Damascus came to face a huge wave of foreign-backed militancy and terrorism. Some of the Arab regimes even began lending financial and logistical support to the anti-Syria elements. Observers say the meeting serves to underline the regional Arab states' interest in resuming their normal relations with Syria, that together with its allies has done much in the way of emerging from the ruins of more than a decade of foreign-backed militancy and terrorism. It's worth noting that the United Arab Emirates used to be among the Arab regimes that backed foreign-sponsored militants operating to topple the Assad government. Experts, however, attribute such signs of rapprochement between Syria and its fellow Arab nations in the region to the Syrian government's ability to recapture vast swaths of its territory and turn the tide against the foreign-sponsored militants and terrorists. The Emirati foreign minister said during his visit to Damascus in November that his country supports efforts to reestablish stability in Syria, adding that what happened in the Syrian nation affected all other Arab countries too. He went so far as to say that Syria, under the leadership of President al-Assad and the efforts of its people, is able to overcome the challenges imposed by the war, noting that his country is always ready to offer assistance to the Syrian people. Yet, the U.S. opposition to warmer relations between its Arab allies and Syria on the one hand, and the UAE's move to normalize ties with Israel on the other, are raising questions about whether a rapprochement is possible between Damascus and Abu Dhabi.
They have seen that that the United States has and its allies have seized, for example, almost $2 billion in Venezuelan gold and then $9 billion in Afghan dollars held in Western banks. And now we're talking about several hundreds of billions of Russian money in Western banks, which is also being now being withheld from Russia. They're basically stealing it. So the UAE and Saudi Arabia are both rethinking whether they want to put all of their oil money into dollars, which are held in Western banks, or whether they need to create new alliances.
The visit by top Syrian Emirati officials are a clear sign that 11 years of foreign-backed militancy in Syria have failed to achieve the desired result, and that those behind the conflict are beginning to realize that. In recent weeks, the United States has deployed several thousand American troops to Eastern Europe for what it calls helping the security in the region. But how can that help the security when it was part of the main problem why Russia attacked Ukraine in the first place? Moscow has become increasingly wary of NATO's expansion toward its borders and describes it as its red line. One can conclude that more American troops in the region can't help achieving peace there at all. Several US and NATO officials have also noted that they are not looking for a direct conflict with Russia, rejecting Ukraine's calls for establishing a no-fly zone over the country and an offer from Poland to give its entire fleet of warplanes to Kiev. So, if there won't be a war with Russia, what objectives are the US and NATO troops in East Europe accomplishing?
Well, for as secretive as the Pentagon is being with this new wave of deployments, the true goal behind them is fairly obvious. Russia has defied NATO hegemony in Ukraine and has proven that they are capable of both militarily and politically rejecting and defending themselves against NATO aggression. So what the Pentagon wants to do with this new wave of deployments is essentially twofold. They want to simultaneously assert NATO's dominance in the near Russia regions like the Baltic states and the rest of Eastern Europe and Central Asia. And they also want to prepare or at least posture for the preparing of further military aid to support either directly or through further NATO deployments.
Even if the troops are there to conduct military drills, which will, by the way, draw the ire of Russia, there should have been a lot more footage and photos of the troops there, as is usually the norm. But data about what the US troops are doing there has been curiously scarce. The number of American soldiers in Europe has increased by several thousands in the last several weeks. That's according to NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg. Speaking alongside the German Minister of Foreign Affairs, the NATO chief said the 30-member military alliance has increased its deterrence and defense, especially in the East, with hundreds of thousands of troops on, quote, heightened alert there. According to Stoltenberg, 60,000 troops are under direct NATO command.
But we face a new reality for our security. So we must reset our collective defense and deterrence for the longer term. Today, we tasked our military commanders to develop options across all domains: land, air, sea, cyber, and space. On land, our new posture should include substantially more forces in the eastern part of the alliance at higher readiness with more pre-positioned equipment and supplies.
US President Joe Biden's policy on NATO is a departure from that of the former Trump administration. Back in 2020, Donald Trump planned to withdraw 12,000 US troops from Germany over a spiraling feud with the NATO ally that he accused of taking advantage of the United States on trade. The former president was also critical of European nations for failing to meet NATO's defense budget. But Biden stopped the measure before it even started. The conflict in Ukraine has given the US another excuse to expand its military presence in Europe. Increasing the number of troops overseas means more military costs, which in the event of a war with Russia would be even higher. Can the US and its NATO allies afford the costs and the risks?
Prior to the special military operation in Ukraine, much of the Western media and the Pentagon itself had essentially doubted Russia's military capabilities of defying NATO hegemony, and they were looking to expand NATO influence into Eastern Europe and Central Asia. So they did not view Russia as a threat prior to the special military operation and the essential evisceration of the Ukrainian military during the process of it. So Russia has proven that they can and will oppose NATO hegemony and will defend themselves against NATO aggression.
So far, the West's response to the conflict in Ukraine has been imposing a slew of sanctions on Russia. Whether that can get them what they want, or it turns out to be shooting themselves in the foot amid a deepening energy crisis, is anybody's guess at this point.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
seventh Imam, Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salatu wa salam, is actually known as Bab al-Hawaij.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام خير الأمور أوسطها.
زيارة of Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim عليه السلام.
السلام عليك يا مولاي موسى بن جعفر ورحمة الله.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome, dear listeners. I'm your host, Mehdi, and we're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Kazim, alayhi salam. Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim, alayhi salam, was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was also the seventh divinely appointed Imam from among the household of the Holy Prophet, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household. Now, we find that Imam Musa al-Kazim's life, in all of its various dimensions, is distinguished in a few things. First of all, he is distinguished in the firmness and the strength for which he stood up for when it came to the right, to truth, to haq. We also find his steadfastness in front of all kinds of events, trials and tribulations, good or bad. And we also see Imam Musa al-Kazim's luminous behavior, his actions, his morals, and his ethics, of which no deviation or crookedness has ever been reported. And finally, the life of Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam is marked by balance. It is in harmony with that of the life of the Prophet Muhammad. These are his dialogues.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام لا ينبغي للرجل أن يدع الطيب في كل يوم، فإن لم يقدر عليه فيوم ويوم لا، فإن لم يقدر ففي كل جمعة ولا يدع.
Imam al-Kazim عليه السلام stated, man should not leave one day without perfuming himself, and if he is not able to do that, then he should perfume himself every other day. And if he cannot do that, then he should do so every Friday without fail.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. In the various conversations and dialogues of the divinely appointed Imam, Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim alayhi salam, we find that Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam advised his companions to show the bounties given by Allah and to be grateful to Allah for these bounties that the Almighty God has given them. So, dear friends, this tradition and this conversation and this dialogue between Imam al-Kazim and his companions continues, and we can talk about it in another program. But just to discuss what was just said by Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam, which was to talk about the bounties given by Allah is considered gratitude. And to leave this idea of talking about the bounties given by Allah is
ingratitude. Now, here it's important for us to remember that talking about the bounties given by Allah does not mean showing off in front of other people. It does not mean throwing this in the face of other people. Oh, I have this and I have that. No, these are actually considered sins. Showing off, riya, is considered a sin. Bragging about what you have in front of another individual, which of course will most probably make them sad and depressed, that is considered a sin because you are hurting the feelings and saddening a fellow brother and sister in iman and in faith. Here, when it is said that talk about the bounties given by Allah is gratitude, is when you thank the Almighty Allah and you verbally speak about these bounties, perhaps to yourself or to your close ones, and you discuss with each other the bounties that Allah has given to each and every one of us. And this is truly gratitude because you acknowledge that the bounty given and the blessing given has been given by the Almighty Allah. But when you don't even talk about the bounties that Allah has given you in a respectful, honorable, and noble manner, right? We say, Allah has given us such a good job. Allah has given us such a beautiful house. Allah has given us such beautiful family members, spouses, children, grandparents, etc. When you talk about these things and you really appreciate these things, this is what is considered one of the first steps towards true gratitude towards the Almighty, the Merciful Allah. This is Dialogue, Imam Al-Kadhim, alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Now let's listen to Brother Muhammad Al-Hilli, who's going to talk about today's topic.
One day he came to the shrine of the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wasallam. When he would enter, Harun would say, "Assalamu alayka yabna al-am." Peace and blessings be upon you, O cousin. Imam alayhi salam would then stand in front of the shrine and would say, "Assalamu alayka ya abata." Peace and blessings be upon you, O my father. Harun would say, "How dare you? How could you call him as your father?" Imam Musa ibn Ja'far would respond to him by saying that if today Rasulullah would come and would want to propose and take your daughter, would you accept? Harun would say, it would be a privilege, something of an honor that I would give Rasulullah my daughter. Imam Musa ibn Ja'far would respond back by saying that he would never ask for my daughter because my daughter is also his daughter and he would not ask for it. And therefore my line is quite straight towards him and I am closer to him. And this idea that was truly powerful influenced the way Harun would deal with Imam Musa ibn Ja'far. And that's why you see that today one of the important aspects that stand out in the life of the Imam is the fact that he spent so many years in prison.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at farstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.